Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and welcome to episode number 120. And we're going to talk about a novel by Dean Koontz called The City. Yes.
Yeah, this was a good one.
This was a beautiful book. Published in 2014, so it's really recent.
Yeah, I think he's got another one coming out very soon, but not yet. So this is his most recent at this point.
Oh, that's cool. Well, great.
I'm not positive.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So yeah, Dean Koontz, if people haven't heard of him, has written a ton of books.
Gosh.
Yeah. A veritable gallimifrey.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's yeah. Like
so prolific.
Yeah, he is. He is, and I've enjoyed him a lot over the years. But this book was magnificent. It was, you know, I've always found him a little more philosophical than most. You know, a lot of the thriller writers and things, you know, it's the thing that kept me going back to him. There was just some quality about him that other writers don't have. It's, you know, ineffable. It's not really something I can point to other than I would leave his novels, you know, feeling like I knew the people that were in there and that I liked the people that were in there usually. Not unlike Stephen King, I guess I'd say, but Koontz has a very different quality than Stephen King.
Oh, yeah. And it's interesting because I think of him as a horror writer, though sometimes what he writes are really more just thrillers, not horror stories. But he does always have kind of that deeper layer underneath. You don't have to see it to enjoy the book. But a lot of his stories, especially the ones up to a few years ago, would have some kind of a horrific thing in them. Perpetrated on someone or some kind of like just a really mentally twisted person. And I know I read one time in an interview where he said, horrible things are out there, but that's not all that's out there. And he always has a wonderful element of good, which is, you know, the people that you were saying, Scott, you know, that you love and identify with and feel like you know who are fighting it. And in that way, he reminds me of The Stand, although not so long as and big as that book. And his books are more consistently that way than, say, Stephen King's books.
That's very well put. Very well put. So, yeah, so this book, again, you know, is his latest. Now, he wrote a book before this called Innocence. Have you read that one?
I have. I read it after this one, and I didn't like it as much. But when I read it, I felt like it was almost like a bookend to this book.
Yeah, and that's an excellent way to put it from what I uncovered. Some people call The City a sequel to Innocence, but that's not really so. It's connected in setting, I guess, because The City in this book is fictional. It's a city of Koontz's making.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
It never was really named.
And I found so that in an interview where he said that. So I know that that's for sure.
Is that the city that's in Innocence also?
Yeah, that's what he said. He said, so the city in Innocence and the city in this book are the same setting. He said, but they have a completely different cast. There's nothing else in common. And he said that he always... I guess Ed McBain wrote the 87th Precinct novels.
Yeah.
And that was a city that didn't exist.
Oh, okay.
And that's where he got his idea. Then. Yeah. That's where he kind of said he envied how he was able to do anything with his city that he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, someday I'm going to do that. So here, this is him doing that.
That really works when I think of Innocence, which is much more of a fantasy sort of a novel. Although the characters are very real, like in this one, in terms of you feeling like you know them. But it's kind of in a sense, like a Beauty and the Beast sort of a situation. But it's definitely feels otherworldly and ethereal when compared to this, because this is the story of a boy from, I guess, from ages 9 to 11. This is told over a couple years, maybe.
Yeah.
And it's
by an adult. I think that that's important.
Right. And he is he is now 57, and he's looking back, and he's telling the story of these eventful years in his life. So you've got a coming-of-age story, and it's set in 1967, I think, or, you know, 5 to 7, or that time period, where everything is very chaotic, and everybody feels like it's coming apart. And
it's cool that you say that. Go ahead.
Huh?
It's cool that you say that, because something in an interview, the same interview that I heard of him on it, he said it in the 60s because he was reading about the 60s, and he realized that back then everybody thought everything was coming apart at the seams, which we kind of think right now. So you said, yeah, that's not going away.
Well, and that's why I liked it, because, I mean, because you also get this boy's personal tale, and there's a tale of that's tinged with the supernatural, some cases more than others. Some you're left wondering what's really supernatural and what isn't, because he himself isn't sure. But in addition to his individual adventure, you're continually being shown the uncertainty of what's going on, the fact that people are having to deal with hard times no matter what. And I liked it because I felt like he wrote it to us right now to show us, like you say, I didn't know that, but to show us that it's just like this sometimes. You know, the 80s didn't feel like that.
Right.
The 90s didn't feel like that, but this feels like that, you know? And so even in those times, it's the families that matter. It's the communities of friends that matter. Those are the ones that get you through everything, even if there's the supernatural, even if there's stuff going on that other people don't know about. And I loved that because I know he's about the same age as the protagonist, as the adult guy. And I know he had a tumultuous childhood. He had an alcoholic father who I think wasn't easy to live with when he was around. And so I kind of wonder also if this is a bit of autobiography of him talking about the kid and how the kid thought, because I felt like the things that the kid assumed, which the adult will comment on, felt really real to me.
Yeah, and me too.
So I liked all that stuff.
Yeah, I thought it was great. It's like, you know, he was an adult with adult observations about himself as a kid. And, and that aspect of it is very interesting. You know, several times he's like, I felt this way, and I feel like that's kind of silly, but I did. You know, I liked how he did it. Yeah, very well done. So a quick synopsis. the book is about Jonah Ellington, Basie, Hines, Eldridge, Wilson, Hampton, Armstrong, Kirk. I did not memorize that. I'm reading it, obviously.
Thank goodness.
And all those names, of course, are famous jazz musicians. And, you know, he was an extremely talented pianist, Jonah Kirk, we'll call him for short.
Yeah.
So the book starts when he's 8, and him and his mother are living together, and his father leaves. And that's sort of the beginning of his, I don't know if you'd call him tumultuous years. I guess I would. Mm-hmm. And it's about 3 years of his life that he talks about. Something about like 3 years. But it's intensely personal. Most of it is told from that point of view. You know, every now and then it jumps away to some things that other people are doing. But generally it's about his life from his perspective, told by himself as an adult, like we said. And he spends quite a lot of time alone in this apartment building, and things start happening, you know, that were happening in the 60s, similar things like, you know, there's some riots and things, and he starts to realize that, you know, as any kid would, he's got a father who left. He's got an intense interest about who his father is, and also a healthy dislike and a fear, I would say, because of his dad did leave and the circumstances in which he left. And then he just begins to realize that his father is into something, and
Well, and I don't even know if it's that so much as he just realizes how untrustworthy his father is, and that his father might, as is the case these days, might do something like kidnap him to get back at his mother. Yeah. So he's already worried. And then a mysterious woman moves in upstairs, and she's very hostile, very freaky, gets really threatening. And he's trying to handle it all on his own because he thinks he should be the man of the family. So he's keeping all these secrets from his mother, who's working two jobs, one at Woolworth, one singing somewhere at night. He comes from a very musical family. His grandfather's very musical, and that's what he does for a living. His mother is. And during the beginning of the book is when he discovers he can play the piano really well, that Jonah can – he has a talent for it. But – it's when the woman moves in that makes him suddenly start looking at and thinking about people in a way that expands on his already distrustful feelings about his father.
Sure.
And that's where the Dean Koontz magic starts to come in, because that's where the supernatural element and it's so cleverly done, because the adult will go, well, as a kid, I didn't realize this and this and this. And you're like, you know, you're saying that. But you just told me some things about how this kid experienced this that makes me think maybe it really was supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this element of doubt thrown in here, because it's the way we remember stuff. We like to rationalize things, too. I thought it was really well done.
Me too. Me too. And those, like you said, those are the moments that really interested me, from that adult speaking of himself as a youngster aspect. And of course, he's not surrounded only by evil people. He's got a neighbor, a Japanese fellow, that he starts to get to know a little bit, and who starts to help. And so he begins to gather around him, you know, his mom and a kid from across the street named Malcolm, and this Japanese fellow, and they become his center or a family, right?
Right.
From which he can operate, and then there's the city, right?
Yeah,
there's the city, and that is a wondrous person who shows up, calls herself Pearl.
He names her Pearl.
He names her Pearl, and so she appears to him, and he speaks to her a few times throughout the novel, and. I don't know that we want to go into too much in this synopsis part, but she's a big player, obviously.
Yeah, she's really mysterious, but it's somehow mysterious in a way that's relatable. I mean, especially to a kid, it's I'm trying to think. He's just sitting there on the steps one morning, and a feather comes down and makes him sneeze and everything. He's wiping his eyes, and he says, I heard a woman say, hey, ducks, how's the world treating you? My mom had a couple of friends who were professional dancers in musicals that were always being talked about by people who loved the theater. And though this woman didn't look like any of them, she did look like a dancer. Tall and slim and leggy, with smooth mahogany skin, she came up the steps so easy, with so little movement, you'd have thought she must be on an escalator. She wore a primrose pink lightweight suit, a white blouse, and a pink pillbox hat with a fan of gray feathers along one side, as though dressed for lunch in some place where the waiters wore tuxedos. In spite of her fine outfit and air of elegance, she sat down beside me on the stoop. Ducks, it's rude not to answer when spoken to, and you look like a young man who'd rather poke himself in the eye than be rude. And that's their introduction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Primrose, right? Primrose dress.
Yeah.
I like
it. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Rose pink. Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly.
I love it.
Her perfume smells like roses.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, I don't know what else to say in this section other than things get very, very bad for him. But obviously he makes it through because he's speaking of himself from the future or from the present, right? Talking about the past from the present.
But it's kind of interesting because this book is one of those where it starts off saying, well, you know, that was when after my grandmother died in this and this. And he goes, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. And so he goes backwards to where his grandmother's alive and takes you through, not directly through it. But by the time you get to where the grandmother dies, you're like, oh, I forgot about that. Mm. It's just the way somebody tells a real story.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of go back and forth that way. And I think he says at the beginning, you know, I know this isn't the right order, but it's the way I have to tell it because this is just me telling a story. And so it's real personal seeming that way.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So super highly recommended before we delve here.
Yeah. It feels really unlike any of the books I've read by him. It's just on a higher level, I think.
I think so too.
It made me really anxious to read his next one.
Yeah. Yeah. And awesome. His previous one. I'm going to go back and read Innocence.
Yeah, I'll be curious to hear what you think of that.
Yeah, definitely will. But yeah, I really think this is a beautiful book. Well worth your time.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't wait to talk about it. So let's do.
Let's do it.
Let's do. And yeah, a lot of beautiful language in this.
He's that way, though. He uses language so well.
Like, here's a couple sentences. When I was 8, I would meet the woman who claimed she was the city. Though she wouldn't make that assertion for 2 more years, she said more than anything, cities are people. And I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. They all have their personality.
Yeah, I like that sentiment. You know, during the last 3 years, I've traveled quite a bit. But I some of the lucky stuff I did, spending time in Chicago was great. And Chicago has a definite character.
Oh, it does. And yeah. I love it.
Yeah, and I love it too.
Yeah.
And spent some time in Miami, and that city's also got a character. enough said. But
never been there.
And you can't make generalizations about all people and stuff. But I was definitely comfortable in Chicago and definitely uncomfortable in Miami.
Well, and it's funny
why that is, I think, is the character of the city and my place in it.
And it's kind of like, in a way, it's kind of like meeting somebody who you've read a lot about. So you have a predisposition one way or the other, but the city itself can change your mind in a second. Because I had this idea that I really wasn't going to like L.A. I'd heard a lot of people say negative things about it. I'd seen it on plenty of TV shows and movies. And we got there and we were driving in off the freeway with, you know, Rose's stuff behind us and everything. And I went, oh my gosh, I just love this place. Why don't they ever show this kind of stuff in the movies that I'm seeing? I mean, I fell in love with it before I got out of the car.
Oh, that's nice.
I was so surprised. And it's that same thing of you meet someone and you click.
Right.
Or you don't. Just yep. That's how it is.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So to think about it that way, you know, as people, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that, just this whole sentiment of it. But yeah, if I was going to say something about this novel that was really important to me and why I thought it was so great is optimism.
Yes.
There's something about it, sometimes overt optimism, but sometimes, you know, just subtle, you know, how it can tell you how to meet the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked, it's interesting, we've talked a lot about, you know, remember when we talked about Stephen Colbert and how he had, you know, some tragedy in his life and he was, you know, it just all seems wrapped up into one big thing, which is what, you know, right? That's what we do here.
That's the face for you.
Exactly.
Gives you a big lens.
It is. And this is a piece of that. This is like a prism or a big magnifying glass. And I read it and I'm uplifted by it.
Yeah, and maybe that's, I'd be interested to hear from somebody who's not Catholic who reads this. When I read reviews, they were about half and half. Some people loved it. Some people said, wow, I wish he wrote the way he used to. But he doesn't, so okay. And I thought, one of the things I liked about it is what you're saying. There were so many things that come together for a Catholic anyway, and of course he is Catholic, which when that was really talked about on Catholic blogs was probably, 8-10 years ago or something, when everyone went, what? And when you're looking for it, you can see it. But I think this book is more obvious than some of them. You know, it's a black family, but they're Catholic.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things that he'll just stop and kind of make aside comments about are also things that he's not presenting them as Catholic, but they're very much in line with the Catholic way of thinking about the world and how you get along and everything.
Yeah, I read a couple of negative reviews, and one of them that I recall said something about that the bad guys were not developed, you know, past cardboard level or whatever. But I was like, you know, well, maybe not. You know, maybe they're not as fully developed, but that wasn't the point of what he was doing, in my opinion. It was almost as if they missed it. I remember one time, a long time ago, I had a conversation with somebody about Star Trek, and they said, you know, usually you get to what's your favorite series or whatever, and I said, I like Deep Space Nine best. And he said, well, there's not enough shooting in that one. So I'm like, you know, clearly we watch Star Trek for different reasons. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's kind of the same thing. It's like Dean Koontz does have this philosophical underpinning to everything that he does. But maybe this book doesn't have enough shooting in it. You know what I mean? It's not satisfying the readers that like that aspect of it best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why maybe they're like, I don't know about this one.
Well, and Innocence is different also, even though it's very different from this. It's different from a lot of his earlier books. Now, I haven't read so many of them. I can just make, well, his earlier work was like this, but I've read a bunch. I've read a bunch of the Odd Thomas ones. I love One Door Away from Heaven. It's one of my favorites.
Hmm.
And I've read one about time travel and one about lightning, or maybe that was the same book. I don't know. Anyway, I've read enough to know that this feels different, and Innocence felt different. And somebody in one of the reviews, maybe on Amazon, put forward the theory that when Dean Koontz's dog Trixie died, and Trixie, I can't remember, I think it might have been the first dog he ever had, and he was just totally in love with that dog, and you know how that is.
Oh, yeah.
Now
yeah.
You have a dog that you're totally in love with, and of course, I've been lucky enough to have a bunch of them, but... And they said they thought when Trixie died, it kind of changed something in him, and he started writing a different kind of book. And I thought, and that's okay, because, you know, things happen in our lives, and they take us to a different level and a different way of seeing things. And isn't that, as an artist, as a creative person, that's obviously going to color what you do. In fact, Jonah, at the end of this, expresses that, right? Now that I think about it, because he talks about, huge spoiler, you know, now I'm crippled. Maybe it's so that I will pay attention to things in a different way. I won't just perform. I'll create and be creative. And he starts writing, you know, he eventually winds up doing musicals and movie scores and all this stuff that he would maybe never have done otherwise, if he could have just always walked around and had his focus on other stuff and gotten a job and, you know, like his grandfather did.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's what happened to Dean Koontz.
What we do, yeah. That's fascinating because, yeah, what we do shapes what we are, right?
Yeah.
You know, our experience shapes things, you know, positive and negative.
Yeah, exactly. And the way you look at stuff, and heaven only knows, this book gives Jonah plenty of lessons on how he could just be sit around and be discontented, because I would argue that the person who is the bad person who's the most developed is his father, Tilton, who we see, he's not, you know, we don't get in his head, but we don't have to. He's just a lazy parasite, and he will go for the easiest thing, and he's very thoughtless. He doesn't stop to think, oh, I'm not taking my wife seriously enough. He just goes, ooh, the lady upstairs who writes about cowboys and rodeos. She seems like somebody I want to be around a lot.
Yeah, you bet.
He doesn't think about consequences. So there are those lessons out there in front of Jonah all the time.
That's for sure. Yeah, and... there was one, this is fairly late in the book too, a paragraph that I absolutely adore. It says, one of the many wonders of this world is that, if we allow it to happen, Anyone newly met can all but overnight become a central figure in our lives, hardly less essential to us than air and water. Although we've made it a world of hatred and envy and violence, the preponderance of evidence proves to me that it is a world created to inspire friendship and love and kindness.
Yeah.
Love that. After tragedy says that. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
It is.
And he keeps hinting at the tragedy the whole time through the book. So by the time the end of the book's come, you're just on pins and needles the whole time. So, yeah. And so, I have to say, I loved the way that the menace in this book was so effective while being so vague, really. It was, what was her name? The woman who was living upstairs, who he followed up there because he'd had a prophetic dream that showed her. Once he meets the city, Pearl, he has a couple of dreams where he sees horrible things happening. And both of them are people who he's destined to meet later. And one of them, he's shut in the trunk of a car, and there's a dead woman there with him. And he sees that woman alive after he's woken up, going up the stairs. So he follows her, and what you expect is she'll be friendly, and they'll work it out together. And she is as hostile and mean and creepy as can possibly be. And she'll do things like show up in a locked apartment and pull out a knife and stick it in the corner of his mouth and go, "Should I keep cutting? I like to cut."
Yeah.
You know, and she'll leave pictures for him on his pillow that she's taken while he's asleep, where she couldn't have possibly really gotten into the apartment to take the pictures, Polaroids, because that's the time it was. And so he enlists Mr. Yoshioka, the upstairs Japanese neighbor, to help him. And Mr. Yoshioka starts experiencing this same level of harassment also. But at the same time, because this horrible thing's happening, it brings them together. They never would have been together. Mr. Yoshioka desperately needs, though he doesn't know it at that point, to reconnect with community and people on a personal level. Jonah needs a father figure so bad. And he, you know, this isn't something they're looking for, but it's what you're saying. These are the friendships that are forged, that people come into your life and that you click.
Yeah, yeah. Overnight becomes a central figure in your life.
Right.
Yeah. I love that sentiment because I've known it to be true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know people in my life that I can't imagine not knowing, you know?
Right.
And you happen to be one of them, by the way.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm listening to you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's amazing how things work.
I know.
And the world is, you know, and I love that idea that, you know, the preponderance of evidence proves to me that it is a world created to inspire friendship and love and kindness.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, it's just that we keep doing terrible things.
Yeah, and we're blind. We're so busy just looking at, you know, where our feet are going or whatever.
Right. And that's a prevailing view in this, which is a very Catholic view, right? That
right.
You know, we're doing this to ourselves. You know, here, this world is created, and it was created with good intention. Yet, you know, these things that happen to us are of our own doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. We're not very kind to each other.
No, and sometimes to the world itself. I mean, I can't find the part I didn't remember to mark it, but there's a time when he and his mother go to the park on her day off, and he's looking at the goldfish in the pond flitting around, and he says, "You know, I still feel this way. Those fish were so alive and colorful and beautiful." And yeah, and he's just talking about how wonderful the world is. And it's that same feeling. It's that same wonder at the beauty of creation. And yet, at the same time, we can marvel at it, and then we kind of feel bad because we know we don't treat it very well a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Sure. Yeah.
Because we're not paying attention. We're just thinking about ourselves, or we're not looking at the bigger picture or whatever.
Yeah.
It's always that double-edged sword, isn't it? But this book communicates all that really well.
It really does. And, you know, in his story, you know, which is just takes so much skill.
Yeah, because what's really compelling, the story that pulls you through so well, is the story of Mr. Yoshioka and him exploring, looking into what's going on in that apartment up there where there's odd smells and strange noises and people are coming and going because they don't quit. And so Mr. Yoshioka starts calling on you know, different members of the Japanese community.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who's an assistant, like a newspaper filing person, somebody whose husband owns a dry cleaner or something, all these various people. And they kind of eagerly embrace, ooh, yeah, I'll do this. In some cases, because they want the adventure. And in some cases, just because, yeah, I'll help you.
Right. And it is a bond, you know, from them being through a similar experience, too.
Right.
We were talking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And they've all been to the internment camps.
Right. And I loved Mr. Yoshioka. I absolutely love the guy.
It was so great.
Yeah. Here's a paragraph about him. Back then, I had a narrow definition of heroism. Now, the guy who's speaking is Jonah, right? Jonah
is
an adult.
Yeah, this is great. Yeah.
Back then, I had a narrow definition of heroism. My conclusion that Mr. Yoshioka lacked courage arose from ignorance, as I later would learn. After you have suffered great losses and known much pain, it is not cowardice to wish to live henceforth with a minimum of suffering. And one form of heroism, about which few, if any, films will be made, is having the courage to live without bitterness when bitterness is justified. Having the strength to persevere even when perseverance seems unlikely to be rewarded. Having the resolution to find profound meaning in life when it seems the most meaningless.
Yeah.
Love that. It's like the Dark Knight, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But it's beautiful. I mean, that's you know, touches me all the way down. I just love that that sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think it's a profound truth.
It is, and it's the thing that we all like to think we could do, but when you're in that position, it's so hard.
Yeah, no question.
How often I fail at that, even just on a very minor level, not talking about big hardships like Mr. Yoshioka has gone through.
Right. Me too.
You know, I guess that's why we have to practice a lot.
That's right. That's right. And it's so Catholic. I mean,
oh yeah.
You know, I'm not claiming it for Catholicism only, but as Catholics, you know, we're taught this, you know, this is the way you should be, you know, it's beautiful.
Yeah, really. If you want an idea of how, I mean, he's not talking about this ever really from a Catholic point of view. This is just, here's how we lived.
This is not a Catholic novel. If you weren't Catholic, you'd enjoy this novel just fine.
Oh, totally. I mean, this is Dean Koontz we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So many millions of books sold.
Right.
You know, that's just, the thing is, though, it's like when you talk about Tolkien or Lewis's fiction, C.S. Lewis's fiction or something, it's the worldview that grounds you that is the anchor to everything you write.
Yeah.
And that's his anchor. And I just think it's coming out more here for us because this is talking about times that are more like ours that we can really relate to. I can relate to being bullied by somebody who frightens me. I can relate to, you know, the unsettling times I see on TV and the fact that things are changing so fast, we don't know what it means. I mean, and not for the better. I mean, at one point he's talking about watching the TV news and, you know, there's the Vietnam War, there are explosions happening, there are murders, of course. But there are all these things happening, and at one point, and I don't know if it's there or earlier, so there was a serial murderer, and then he says, on the first day of August, an honors student named Charles Whitman climbed to the top of the 27-story University of Texas tower and with a rifle killed 16 and wounded 30, an unprecedented slaughter that alarmed the nation because it felt not like an aberration, but like the start of something new. And I think about all the school shootings.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, we don't have a handle on things. This is when it becomes clear we don't have a handle on things. And how do you cope with that? I mean, because we've got ISIS, we have terrorism. And we don't have, you know, then they had the free love thing and all that kind of social revolution going on. And now we've got all this revolution and turmoil in our sociological stuff going on.
The most difficult part of that is the feeling that people with traditional values are being, I want to use the word eliminated. It's almost, you know, in thought eliminated.
Denigrated or dismissed.
I think dismissed is how I'd say it. And that is a very common thing with the 60s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so yeah. it kind of echoes.
Your opinions are worthless, and, you know, we're not thinking that way anymore, so sorry, pal.
Yeah, you're not with the times. Get with it, you know, Woodstock, let's go.
Exactly.
The Beatles. and all that stuff. Now we look back now and go, but you know what? We made it through. And I imagine in another 20, 30 years, we'll look back and go, yeah, we made it through.
Mm-hmm.
But what comes out the other end? We're still living what we have now was rooted in some of that. You know, the good and the bad.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which is just how things are. And it's kind of what G.K. Chesterton said, is we always think of the past as it's a much more settled place. And we think of, you know, right now as it's the craziest, worst time ever. And that's always the way it is.
That's right. It's like, I know we say cities have character, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You know, we've talked about how a person is, you know, a total of their experience. You know, that's not all they are, but their experiences alter who they are today.
Right.
You know, what they do today, what they create, and how cities have a certain character. You know, they're the people that are there, and they have a character. And then now we're talking about the nation, and mm-hmm. the nation has a history, and we're standing on that history today. We're standing on the 60s. You know, it's almost, you know, the 60s produced the 70s, produced the 80s, produced right. the 90s, produced where we're at.
Right.
And, you know, there's a whole character to the nation as well. And, you know, that's what the fight is over. But yeah, it's just interesting to think about it as, you know, when you start to really think about it as a collection of people,
mm-hmm.
And to have, you know, I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud here, but to have that character as a person, and then he embodied the city in a person,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, she ended up maybe not being the city, but
well, that's the last spoiler. Yes.
But it's fascinating to think about. You know, if America was a person, who would that person be? You know?
It depends on who you're asking, right?
I think it does.
They'll say one thing. You ask us, we'll say something else.
Absolutely true. Yeah.
The French, they'll say, I mean, we think of the British and the French as having, and Australians and Canadians, we think of them as having their own national character. So
we do. Yeah, we do.
Right
or wrong, you know, I base that character not on any personal knowledge whatsoever. You know, not that I haven't met an Australian, you know, I've met Australians, but I'm just saying right. that never having been there, my opinion of what Australia is probably completely inaccurate.
I feel like they're a lot like us, just a little more personality out there.
And they've all got pool rooms.
Oh, yeah, mate.
That's right. From the castle.
Watch
the castle, everybody.
Well, and I liked one thing I really liked about this, because this is overwhelming to anyone. And I think in the last podcast, did I read you that quote from C.S. Lewis about how to not be afraid?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in this, it's kind of the same thing, but it's a more practical take. The C.S. Lewis had said, you know, you can believe in the things around you, or you can believe in God. Well, the things around you may change a lot, but God won't change. So, but what Dean Koontz says essentially is the mother comes home and Jonah is watching TV, and he says, everybody's killing everybody. And he's just freaked out, because he's like, everything could just be blown away and I'd be so alone. Mm. And so what she points out is that you have to be careful about what you pay attention to, because she says, you know, all this stuff on the news, they're picking what to show you. They're not showing us fixing dinner for Mrs. Lorenzo downstairs. They're not showing the nice things people are doing for each other. And there's so many more of those than there are this stuff on TV. And she says, riots come and go, wars come and go, but under the tumult, day after day, city after, or century after century, millions of people are doing nice things for one another, making sacrifices, mostly small things. But it's all those little kindnesses that hold civilization together, all those people who live quiet lives and never make the news. And then the weather comes on and they're showing a tornado. And she says, when weather's big news, my mother said, it's a hurricane, a tornado, a tidal wave. 99.9% of the time, Mother Nature isn't destroying things, she's nurturing us. But that's not what gets ratings or sells papers. And
that's so true.
Yeah, and that example is one that really kind of came to life for me. I was talking to a young woman who about some, she had some questions about, a very faithful Catholic, but she had some questions about, you know, hot button issues. And we were talking and she was using terrible examples of things she'd seen on the news lately. And I said, but for every one of those, there's 1,000 or 10,000 that didn't react that way. And I used the example of the weather because we just had a lot of rain and flooding. And I said, you know, I got a tweet or a text from each coast within 10 minutes of each other. I said, that's when I knew our weather had hit the national news. My mom in Florida, Rose in LA. Is everything okay? Have you built an ark yet? That kind of thing. And I said, look outside today. No one's going to notice. No one's going to care. But how many days do we have like this? And she was like, you're right. I mean, it's the best practical example ever of you've got to divorce yourself from all the hype. You know, wow. you think about how we can build up the political stuff with all the debates and this and that. And I'm like, and I mean, even our priest, he was like, oh, just this and this and this. And he's very upset about the politics. And I'm like, I'm not worrying about that yet. And he goes, what? And I said, I have no control over that. When I can vote, I'll have almost no control, but I'll go in and vote.
Yeah.
And we'll see what happens. And I can't worry about these 9 or 10 people who are arguing or these 2 or 3 people who are arguing and what they're saying. I don't get to pick.
Right. That is very true. And that's a healthy way, too. I got to do some more of that myself.
Yeah. All the time.
Right. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I mean, it helps your optimism, right?
Yeah.
Which is good. You know, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. You know, everybody's running around being pessimistic, but yet, you know, we still have so much going for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really stunning, you know, when you look back at history and, you know, what we have today. But yet to be bummed out all the time and worried about this and that, man, what a waste.
I know. Well, and think about it, too. The other thing history is a good corrective for is our country has been having these kind of violent political struggles from the beginning. I think the only thing that happened that wasn't contested was George Washington being president. Everybody agreed on that. And
they all said, yeah, he was a good guy, right? And also, since then, we've been fighting, yeah.
Yeah, also Eisenhower being president, either party, both parties wanted him to run under their banner. You know, so the Democrats found someone else because he wouldn't do it, but that's how popular he was. I mean, so that wasn't quite as universal as Washington. But I mean, you read back on all that stuff and the vicious way those things were done, and it's just the same as now. We just like to think it should be better, and it should be better, but why do we feel like it should be better? Because there's something built into us that is the compass that knows how things should be.
Because the preponderance of evidence proves to me that it is a world created to inspire friendship and love and kindness. And, you know, and the thing is, we've seen it. We've seen it.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, we're sitting here hoping, although we are doing that, but we've seen it. We've seen it.
Picture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? We know that it's possible because in our lives, we've got these times that, you know, that things are going the right way and you're just like, that's the way it should be all the time.
Right.
And we want it to be.
And when people band together to help things become the right way or to try and help somebody who's been through something awful, that's also that expression of that kindness, and we know how it should be. We'll try to get it back. We can't fix it all the way.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was having that conversation with that young woman, I had been giving a talk that I didn't want to, I mean, it's not like I didn't want to give the talk, but it's not something I was seeking out, and it's not something I'm like, oh yeah, I get to give a talk. I was just like, okay, I'm going to give this talk. Well, I got done talking to her, and she was like, I think you were sent here to talk to me. And I was like, I knew I was here for a reason, but you're my reason. You're the reason.
Yeah.
You know, there's something bigger also.
Yeah, I love that feeling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which really takes us to the city.
It does. And just one moment before we get to her.
No, no, no.
This is a statement that I also consider very Catholic and maybe, I don't know, it's realist, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In my case, having had prophetic dreams and having had a piano conjured for me by Miss Pearl, I knew that the world was a many-layered mystery. Everyone told me voodoo was nonsense, and I didn't really believe in pin-stuck effigies and effective curses. But I did believe a devil walked the world, ceaselessly harvesting. I just like that paragraph, too.
How did I miss that paragraph? I've read that book twice. Wow, what a great paragraph.
Right. So I just love it. So he, you know, that is, again, it's a realistic statement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people don't believe in the devil nowadays, right? But this is sort of my, you know, a way that I view the world. Again, yeah. I'm still very optimistic. I love to be optimistic. I try to be optimistic. But a devil walks the world ceaselessly harvesting.
Well,
we know that.
We were promised that. I mean, that's St. Peter, right? Or, yeah.
Right.
Peter says, oh, crap, and now I can't remember it. But, you know, that you're the enemy is ceaselessly prowling around you like a lion,
mm-hmm.
waiting to gobble you up.
That's
Be
right.
careful. Pay
that's
attention.
Right.
And that stuff all sounds like superstition, but no matter what you call it, there is evil in the world. That's one of the things that people who don't believe in God protest so much, because they're like, why is this awful thing here? And it's like, well, we have a name for that. You know, sometimes we do it to each other, but sometimes it's from an outside force that hates us.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, exactly.
Heavy duty.
Go ahead.
No, please go. Yeah.
No, I was going to say one of the things that I really liked in this book, too, was suddenly it got to a point where Jonah was taken to see art and architecture and things of beauty that were just around. And I really loved that emphasis on beauty. He had mentioned it, as I said before, you know, seeing the koi swimming in the pond and thinking about the universe and the world and everything.
Wow, that reminds me of our very first podcast.
Oh, yeah, you know, you're right.
Fish
the
swimming.
Weavers are the angels.
That's right. It's like the very first thing. God is a, what is it? God is a
tricky God.
A tricky God, that's it, yeah.
He'll move you to where you got to be.
Uh-huh.
Which That's is kind right. of that theme we always keep coming back to.
That's right.
Because that was kind of a prophetic book, right?
It was, yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
It is funny.
Well, because one of the things that I've come to appreciate more and more as the years have gone by, fairly recently, I would say, is art and what you can see in art. And people talk about, oh, you really like picture books, because I'm always trying to tell people, I'd like to do, wouldn't you like me to do a book for you? And it could have pictures in it. And they're like, oh, what's with you? But he, at one point, Jonah is looking at this picture, which is a picture that breaks my heart, so I don't even like to think about it, called The Goldfinch.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen it or heard of it, I guess?
No. I may know it if I see it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll look it up while you're saying that.
There was a book, I think, that was written that the author was inspired by the painting, so they called it The Goldfinch. So more people have heard of it recently. And I can't say the guy's name, Carol Fabritius. He's Dutch from a long time ago in the 1650s. And it's basically a, it says, the backdrop is a sunlit wall, and on the wall hangs a feeding box, perhaps 10 inches by 6, on which the little bird perches. The finch is restricted to the box by a fine link chain attached to one of its feet, a chain at most 2 feet in length, allowing it to test its wings and fly only to change its position on the box, condemning it to a markedly more limited and miserable existence than that of a parakeet in a large cage.
Wow. Yeah, I'm looking at it now.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. So he's talking about, you know, you just look at that and it just breaks your heart. And of course, that's why I don't even like to think about it. But he says that, you know, the bird is looking out at you or out of the painting.
Mm-hmm.
And it says something in its posture said it could never be restrained. It could be restrained, but never broken by restraint. Suggested stoic suffering that if I dwelt on it too long would reduce me to tears. And then he says, the bird's circumstances and attitude were still not entirely what so affected me. What started me trembling was its right eye. In the painting, the left eye was shaded, but in the right glimmered a liquid drop of light, a simple bit of mastery that convinced me that this painted bird could indeed see. Its stare was direct, but more than merely direct. There was a depth to the eye, as if not only the bird looked through that eye at its keeper, but as if all of nature looked and saw and knew the extreme cruelty of this imprisonment. No, not just that. Suddenly I knew what the painting meant to me, and I thought I knew what it meant to the painter. Many who believe in God also believe that he is not merely the creator of all nature, but is in all of nature, that he is everywhere with us in some way beyond our easy comprehension, that he is acutely aware and caring. In the right eye of the goldfinch, I saw the bird gazing at his keeper, all of nature gazing too, but also through that moist and feeling eye, the maker, capital M, of the keeper watched and saw and loved the keeper for his potential, but mourned his cruelty. Love and sorrow informed that eye, and it regarded me as surely as it regarded the keeper of the bird, saw me and knew the good and the bad of me, knew my courage, but also my cowardice, knew the lies I had told.
Wow.
Like the bird, I was chained, and the links in the chain were my lies. So I was both bird and keeper, chained and endangered by my own actions. And I'm like, oh. So I picked myself up off the floor after I read that.
Wow.
It just went, holy crap, that was found.
That was something else.
I mean, what a way to... Well, for one thing, it's kind of a center of obviously how Dean Koontz feels about the world.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly a Catholic way to think about it. But also, what art can mean to each person. Nobody else there is affected that way. They have different paintings they like.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you know, we all have those moments when we're just so moved, whether it's music or art or a book like this one or... you know, some other thing like that where it's God reaching you in a way that surprises you because you did not expect it.
Yeah, yeah.
And he captured that sort of an experience so well.
Oh, it was, yeah. So well done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Just one of those flashes, and you know, and that hit, those things hit you in a flash.
Yeah. Yeah.
Later, you put the whole paragraph to it like that, and you go, that just still doesn't explain it, but it's as good as I could do. You know, it's that ineffable experience. And
sure is.
And I just loved that idea of not only in the art, but in, you know, of course, the world around us in nature. That's how we're reached. But then that's why I feel sad about a lot of the ugliness of, like, you know, some modern churches or our houses and things where you go and look at the really ancient places like in – Rotensburg? Am I saying it right? Anyway, Germany,
mm-hmm.
where you go by and it's a completely restored medieval town. And I'm like, even the hinges on the freaking shutters are little grasshoppers and toads and things. Little bits of art all around them.
Wow. It's nice.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Just amazing. Sorry. No, I love it.
Went off on a huge tangent there.
It's okay. No, and then into this world walks Pearl.
Yeah.
Or who? How do we want to approach this? This is, let's talk about Pearl as the Because, you know, yeah, I mean, here we are. We're looking at the city. We're looking at this worldview. But into this walks Pearl, into the place where the Goldfinch was painted, right?
Right.
In walks Pearl. And you already read the introduction, you know, the first time that they met. Mm-hmm. There was a time that they met where she said something that I think is practically a theme. It's almost instructions for life, right?
Okay.
No matter what happens, disaster piled on calamity, no matter what, everything will be okay in the long run. Yeah.
So Jonah's totally confused.
He's totally confused, right? So he says, I spread my fingers to filter my words. You said you can't see the future. I'm not talking about the future, Dux. Not the way you mean. Not tomorrow and next week and next month. Then what are you talking about? I said, frustrated. She repeated, no matter what happens, everything will be okay in the long run. If you believe that, if you trust me, nothing that might happen in the days to come can break you. On the other hand, if you won't take to heart what I've just told you, I don't expect things will turn out as well as they could. I mean, that's intensely profound as well.
Well, it is, and it really, you feel with Jonah his confusion, because you're reading it going, what? What do you mean? No matter what, whether it's bad or good, disasters or not, everything will be okay in the long run. What are you talking about? Because that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. She's talking about the very long run.
Yeah. She's talking about the really big picture.
Right, right.
And plus she does stuff. She doesn't just show up and talk to him and say, I'm the city. She gives him a feather in lucite or something like mm-hmm. that he can wear around his neck on a chain that is kind of like a good talisman for him. The feather itself will change in appearance. She shows up in his room when he's woken up from a terrible dream and gives him a significant name that goes with the dream. You know, mm-hmm. she, of course, since if you haven't read the book, we've ruined it for you already. So, you know, she brings him back from death.
Mm-hmm.
She basically finds another timeline, in essence, where he doesn't die.
Right.
And then at the end, you really then start to understand what she meant, because she, at one point, right after the part you read, she says, he starts to cry because everything's too much for him. And she's like, oh, okay, I never let anyone do this, but I'm going to let you look at my purse. And he's like, what? She says, just look at my purse. And so he does. And then he won't tell you what he saw.
Mm-hmm.
But it was something amazing. So at the end, he does tell you what he saw.
Right.
And I'm not... Go ahead.
No, I said right. I'm waiting to hear it.
Well, I was going to say, I wasn't going to read it, but I was thinking of right before he's telling what he saw, he's talking about, as I rose with Miss Pearl out of death, just as I passed back to life, I knew she was not the soul of the city made flesh, or at least that she was not only the city, that she was not just black as she appeared to me, that she was of all races and continents and times, that she wore no rose perfume, but was herself the embodiment of the rose, that she was the mother of the ancient story, that I had known her not just as when I was eight, since I was eight, but always. Any Catholic is going to look at that and go, oh, holy crap. Mary?
Yeah. Hello.
Are you there?
Mary, Mother of God. Yeah.
Yeah. Holy Mary, Mother of God, because she's everyone's mother. She is, the rose is her flower. She is, there's a rose perfume that they say you will smell if she's, you know, would ever appear like in apparitions of her. When it says she's the mother of the ancient story, I instantly thought of, I believe it's in the book of Daniel when God is called Ancient of Days.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, she's the mother of Jesus. And, then, you know, and the thing about what she sees in the purse, if you want to read that, you can. I don't know if it's too long.
Well, I think that we should, because I think that it's also something really important.
Okay.
Would you do it?
Oh, do you want me to?
Yeah, okay. I really do. Yeah.
Well, I will.
Please do.
The purse. Put your face right down close to it, ducks. Right down close. Then you'll see. At first, I had seen a confusing agglomeration of angled shapes thrusting toward me, but then they resolved into the skyscrapers of a city in miniature, and I was gazing down through those buildings into a maze of busy streets, gazing down and then falling down, not with fear but with exhilaration, swooping between those glittering towers, flying as sometimes I had flown in good dreams. The city was no longer a miniature. It was real and vast, borderless, reaching to infinity, filled with gorgeous and mysterious light. I flew low, near street level, along avenue after avenue, alive with busy people, and I began to realize that the mysterious light came from them, that it came from me too, that we were the people of the city and the light of the city. Flickering like endless tiers of candles in endless cups. And suddenly I saw the city in time, backward to its origins, and forward through centuries as it had been and as it would be, all existing now and in every age, those ancient and those of the future. The lovely light did shine, our light. What a purse.
Oh my gosh. That completely, I mean, as if the rest of the book didn't, but that was just like, is stunningly beautiful. And it's like eternity.
Right? I have to say, reading it out loud was a completely different experience. That you should do that.
Cool.
It just takes you in a different way. I was like, wow.
Wow.
Yeah, and think of what an exciting vision of eternity that is.
Yeah.
If that's what eternity is.
Because that's what we think, you know, it's almost outside of time, you know. How can you see in the same thing the future and the past and everything all at once? And yet here it is, you know, laid out in our imagination. It's so well done.
And the new heaven and the new earth, right?
Exactly.
At the end of time, it's the holy city of Jerusalem and the new heaven and the new earth. And it's like, what an imagination that makes you go, I want that.
Yeah.
You know, and we need those visions of what it could be, because the old ones worked for those times, but they don't work for us. And we need those moments of inspiration again. Like you said, the optimism, the no matter. And that's the last sentence of the book. When I'm confused, I recall what she said that day, and I can hear her voice remembered as clearly as I remember any music I've ever heard. No matter what happens, disaster piled on calamity. No matter what, everything will be okay in the long run.
And there's such power in that.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, it's something that we strive to, and we can't always do because we're very afraid. At least I am.
Right.
You know, it takes me a long time to move. But it's like, man, if you could really achieve that, I don't know if that's nirvana or, you know, I know Buddhism is different, but it's just... there's amazing power in that. Amazing freedom, right?
I think the people who can remember that all the time are saints.
Yes, I think so too.
And ironically, the only way they can remember it all the time is by continually being pushed out of their comfort zone by the Holy Spirit.
Mm.
You know, that St. Francis says the Holy Spirit makes us uncomfortable. He pushes us, he moves us forward, and we like to be comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is when you go out on the edge, when you take those chances, when you make yourself vulnerable and take risks, is when you have to trust. And that's when you have to trust everything will be okay in the long run. I'm doing the best I can. I'm not in control of this. And just like in this book, it just doesn't mean you're not trying. Everyone in this book is trying as hard as they can to make things okay. I mean, I totally loved the grandfather at the end.
Me too.
He was watching every night in the shed because he's like, the cop's probably okay. But, you know, I've had a long time as a black man with cops. I'll just keep an eye out too.
He was a good man. I liked him a lot. Yep.
And with his baseball bat.
Yeah. And with, and the way- yeah, after the accident, or accident, after Jonah goes through what he goes through and becomes crippled, what the grandfather does for him and helps him, mm-hmm. and that was amazing. Great relationships.
Well, oh, yeah. Well, and I also really love that it's, you know, the end of the disaster, people are the big threat, and people are dead or wounded or whatever, and Tilton's there. And he's just, he's so weak and ineffectual on both sides, right?
Yeah.
And it says, Tilton got up from the piano bench. "Mr. Bledsoe, I'm no threat to you or to anyone. Let me go. You'll never see me again, I swear. You know you never will, you know." After regarding Tilton in silence for a long moment, Grandpa said, "Sit down." And Tilton sat. Because you get the feeling no one ever made Tilton do anything.
That's great. You know? You know, some people have that power, though.
Yeah.
My own grandpa, I remember way back when, my oldest brother, he may shoot me for telling this story, but I'm going to do it anyway.
We won't tell
him. He was in college, right? And he was going to quit college and go across the country and sell magazines as a way to riches. And he had told my parents this, and no amount of talking was going to get him not to do this, right? So we ended up, we visited my grandparents in Florida for a Christmas, I believe. And my brother told my grandpa this plan. And my grandpa went and waved his hand. And it was never spoken of again.
I love it.
That was it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, I can, you know, I see that in that moment that you just said. Yeah, there's certain power. I don't know.
Well, those are people, you know, in your life who have that influence.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, well, he wanted his approval so badly.
Right.
That when he didn't have it, it was devastating.
Well, and your father and might have.
He didn't have to say anything either. Yeah, yeah.
On your children, your father might have that influence, but he wouldn't have had it on your brother because he's your father.
Right.
Too close to him or something.
Exactly. Who knows what. But
yeah, or just a personality thing or whatever.
Exactly. But yeah, I love those. That's just a moment.
I just love that. That's great. Yeah. Well, yep. And that's like, you know, and some people are just formational in your life like that. That, I mean, for me, my grandparents, my one set of grandparents are that way. I still try to, in difficult situations, what would Raymond and Thelma do? And I try to, you know, that's how I kept from being really horrible, pushy mother of the bride. I just was like, well, how would, okay, you're going into a day that could be difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't be too pushy over how you think things should go. This is not your wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Blah, blah, blah. And it's, would I have been pushy? Probably, because I wanted things to go right. But I mean, I had nothing to do with planning it, but that doesn't mean I wouldn't be pushy. And so I just spent the whole time going, if I felt those impulses, I was like, what would they have done? No, they wouldn't have done it. They wouldn't have said anything. They'd have smiled, a bit polite. And that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's fascinating. You know, I see here, I'm really glad that my grandpa came up today because he lost his leg, one of his legs, in a construction accident. So I never knew him when he wasn't, you know, limping around with a, you know, plastic leg. And he never complained once. I never saw it. You know, maybe I wouldn't have seen it if, because I was a kid, but he was always so funny, and he just always seemed to have this optimism. It was like, yeah, this happened, but so what? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm gonna keep going. It's not gonna stop me from living my life. And he was always that way. So it was, you know, it's great. Funny. It's just like, you know, the story in a way where, yeah, you know, Jonah, you know, feels sorry for himself, but is pulled right out of that, you know,
mm-hmm.
and says, you know, you can do this, and he did.
Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, my grandpa did have a lot of influence. He was somebody I cared about quite a bit, but it's, so I like that he came up.
No, that's neat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And an
Alexander is his name.
Okay.
And yeah, guess who's named after
him? Oh, yeah, I guess Alex. Daughter Alex.
That's right. That's right.
Okay. Yep. That's neat.
Mm-hmm. You bet.
Yeah.
So, but wonderful book. Really wonderful book.
Yeah, I know. And actually, Rose is the one who recommended it to me.
Oh, good.
And yep. I said, oh, I'm, you know, we're going to talk about this. And she just got this huge smile on her face and said, that's such a great book.
Ah, very cool. Well, good. Hello, Rose.
Hey, Rosie.
When is she going to be back on? We need her back.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I have to come up with a movie or something.
You bet. You bet.
Though she talks about, I mean, she talks about everything, books, movies, everything.
Whatever. Cool.
Yeah.
Terrific. Terrific.
Have some Nathaniel Hawthorne. She'll do it in a split second. She loves him so much.
All right. All right. Well, good. Well, do we have anything else to say about the city?
No, I did kind of like also the way that he would use the past to shed a less than approving light on the future sometimes. And it wasn't always just going, we don't do this right. But it was just like, though there's one point where he's waiting for to turn in an order to go in a restaurant. He's like, oh, I could smell this and I could smell that and I could smell people's cigarette smoke and I could smell this. And he goes, if you didn't live back then, you didn't understand how tolerant everybody was of each other's foibles. Huh. We didn't let it upset us. And then he just moves on. And I'm like, thank you.
Yes, saying, indeed. Yeah. That's right. You know. Yeah. Seems just like, yeah, things. We got to live exactly a certain way or we're not in. And if we're not in, we're out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like I was watching, what was it? I don't know if you've heard of this show, I'll Have What Phil's Having.
No. It's
Phil Rosenthal, who was the creator and main writer for Everybody Loves Raymond. And he had a 6-episode series on PBS where he got to go to all these different cities like Lisbon and wherever. And LA was one of them. And he'd just go all over the city and try different foods and restaurants and things like that. And he and, no, gosh, Allison Janney or some actress. Anyway, we watched the LA one and it's streaming on PBS because I came across it so late. We're going to have to go backwards and watch the others. But in the LA one, they're sitting in this food court type place that, of course, being LA is like the best food court type place ever. And they're each having a hot dog or something. And somebody is just walking by and leans in between them and says, just because it's humanely raised doesn't mean it's okay to eat meat. And then just goes walking on. And they both just look at each other like, what just happened? I was like, that's it. We all have to live the way you want, so you aren't offended by your, blah, blah. And I was like, ugh.
Oh, man. Yep.
He was just laughing. He was, because he's such a huge nerd. It's so great. He's so intense, and it's great. And he goes, I can't believe that just happened. He goes, I love it, but I can't believe it. He goes, what about manners? Do those count for anything?
Oh, shoot.
It just cracked me up.
That is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you, Mr. Koontz.
Yes, this was a good book. One.
Yeah, and I've got a, I went through a period where I read a lot of Koontz. Yeah, I read, so his early stuff like Phantoms is one that I loved, and Hideaway. Hideaway was about this guy who had an accident, and when he came back, he had an angel inside. Wow. And the angel was basically dispatched to take care of a serial killer who was demonically possessed.
Whoa.
Yeah, very good book. Hideaway. Yes. And it was a movie with Jeff Goldblum. Yeah.
He seems unlikely.
Yeah.
I
remember it being a pretty good movie.
Okay.
But then after that, I went through a period where I read everything that he had, and it was kind of my early audiobook phase because his audiobooks were terrific. Dragon Tears, read by J.O. Sanders, was magnificent.
Can't write fast enough for all this. Okay.
Yeah, Dragon Tears is a lot of fun. And then Intensity which the entire book takes place like in something like a day or two. It's about this girl. I don't know if you like this one or not. It's about this girl who's, if I remember the details right, she was staying at someone's house and the people at the house get murdered.
Oh, right.
And she runs outside and hides. Yeah, she hides in this RV that happens to be his, and he gets in it and drives away, and she's inside. Oh. And it was intense. Yeah,
it was intense.
That's the title.
I don't know if I could listen to his books. I think I have to have more separation the first time through.
It was, yeah. I'd love to listen to him.
Well, then, have you read One Door Away from Heaven?
I have not.
Oh, my favorite one.
Yeah, so I've got to read that. And then another pair that I liked a lot. There was one called Fear Nothing.
Okay.
And I'm trying to remember the one that kind of was a sequel slash pair with it. But it was about this guy. I'm pretty sure Fear Nothing is the first of the two. And it's about this guy who has a disease that he can't get light on him. It's a real disease. So if you go outside, you get sunburned really badly.
Oh. Okay.
You just can't handle sunlight. So he has to live at night.
Awful.
And so he's like in a fairly small town, and things start to happen at night, and he's he's awake, obviously, and so he ends up being detective slash witness to
I've got to get some
these
of these
happenings.
Yeah. And then there's one that goes with it, like a bookend type.
Yeah I just don't remember the name of it. Yeah, one of the books is blue and one of them is white. Yeah, but I'm pretty sure Fear Nothing is the first one.
Okay.
Yeah. But with this, I'd love to pick this up again and keep going. I really want to read his Frankenstein novel.
I also am interested in that. And now the first time I tried, because he write, there's several of them and each of them has a different co-author. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, well, I remember.
Are you right about that?
Yeah, I think that they got republished, though. I don't think that they have co-authors, because I think the first one, somebody let me know if I'm wrong here, but it's called Prodigal Son.
Yes.
And it was originally by Dean Koontz and Kevin J. Anderson.
Okay.
And the next time it got published, it says Dean Koontz.
Oh,
and he explains in the introduction that he's not all that easy to work with. And he had this idea, and he brought in, however the match was made. He just I just got to finish this.
Just ran over the guy, the
exactly,
other guy.
Exactly.
It's,
and
got,
he was,
well,
he seemed apologetic. I hope everybody's friends. But it was like, yeah, I wrote this. I wrote this whole thing. And I didn't give him a chance. So, so I think that you're right. I think they originally all had co-authors, but I don't think that they do now.
They just came out and were honest about it. Well, and I think the first time I picked up the first one, and I had not read the actual Frankenstein at the time, and I kind of got partway into it and went, but now I've read Frankenstein twice.
Yeah.
And so probably
it makes it more interesting.
Context I didn't have. Yeah.
Because what did he see in that was so compelling that he was like, I really have something to do here. And
Well, the Frankenstein story, come on. It's got something.
Yeah, it's fascinating. But what did he take? Yeah. What did he do?
Yeah.
So I really want to read that one.
Well, you haven't read any of the Odd Thomas books, right?
I haven't. No. Okay. I saw the movie. There was a movie, Odd Thomas.
Oh, yeah.
So I have.
Which I meant to see.
Yeah.
How was it?
Fine.
Okay. Then I don't mean to see it that
way. Yeah, maybe 3 of 5. It was fine.
I liked the first, I guess, 3 really well. There were 6 or 7 of them.
Yeah.
And the 4th one was okay. And the 5th one I did not like. And then there was, I guess there were 7. And the 6th one I didn't even read. And the 7th one I picked up because it just came out, called Saint Odd. And I was like, well, so I started reading it and I went, oh my gosh, you're kidding me. I am not. I looked at it and went, I believe this is like a retread of something else that, anyway, I was not happy. So I just kind of leafed through it and got to the end. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Mr. Koontz. I know you're never going to listen to this, but, you know, not my favorite. I liked the first three really well. That's gotcha. All I can say.
Well, that's cool.
But, yeah. Good. But anyway, but mm-hmm. the last one kind of ended up the way I would expect it to end up. So.
Okay.
If that's what you wanted, then yay.
And fascinating. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first one. Totally good. The second one, really interesting. The third one, very intriguing. And, you know, and then a lot of people liked all the other books. So.
Okay.
I'm, you know how I am.
Oh, sure. Kind of, you bet. You bet.
Kind of a jerk sometimes.
No. All right. Well, great. Well, we've run long.
Oh, my gosh. Yep. Sorry, everyone.
Thanks for listening, everybody. I guess we should mention what we're doing next, huh? Just one, oh, yeah? one. Let's just mention one thing.
Okay.
So yeah. So next up is Skyfall.
Yep.
So
cannot wait.
We're going to talk about that. Yep. All right. A little James Bond.
So perfect timing.
You bet.
What with the new movie and all.
That's right. That's right.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yep. We'll talk to you later. Please, yeah,
enjoy some Dean Koontz.
Yes, there's so much to choose from.
All right. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
See you later. Bye-bye.